So this is the third day of this four-day retreat here in October 2012 at the Franciscan Center in Tampa, focusing on the life and teachings of the great Indian yogi, hermit, master, Buddha, Milarepa, and subtitled Enlightenment is available for anybody. And of course, when you make statements like anybody or everybody, that means everyone sitting here today is included in that. And I think we've already, heard very clearly from the Venerable Milarepa, where he says clearly, in numerous ways we've already heard, that if anybody sincerely and consistently and persistently puts these teachings into practice, they will attain realization of that, there is no doubt. And actually, all the masters have said that. So again, we can continue, as many of us do, heeding the words of our own internal voice. Oh, you know why? I didn't turn it on. Yeah, that's a good point. But everybody heard me? Yeah, so this is just extra. We pretend we need technology. So again, we have the consistent voice of the Buddha, and every of his students, disciples, and the continuous lineage, no matter whether it went down into India, up to Tibet, over to China, down into Vietnam, over to Korea, Japan, down into Southeast Asia, and now to America and the West, every master has said the same thing. Awakening is possible for everyone. And that the Buddhist path is a very clear path, is a very practical path, it's a very well set out path, it's a tried and true path. There is absolutely no reason to doubt it. In Buddhism, there are sort of five mind states that are considered poisons. One of them, interestingly enough, is doubt. And this is not the doubt of the questioning mind doubts there may be a self, doubts there may be a mind. That kind of doubt is good doubt. It's good to doubt a lot of the conventions of the things we take as true and real. This is two kinds of doubts that are considered poison. Poison toxic to one's capacity to make advancement on the path. One of these, of course, is to doubt the teachings. And this is, again, not saying, because you know the Buddha actually and was very clear saying, subject my teachings to your rational mind, to logical mind. Test it with experience. So this is not this is not saying that you cannot, when you encounter the Buddhist path, encounter the Buddhist teachings, you cannot, investigate them, examine them, test them for your own logic and experience. But what it means is, having done that, and one should have done that in the early stages of their practice, once you've kind of become convinced the coherence of the teachings, the lives of the teaching master and masters leading. Develop practitioners who you can identify with in your own culture and life, who seem to have be proof that the teachings do have this healing, transformative quality. At that point, you make a commitment, right? And once you make that commitment, to continue to doubt the validity of the teachings, which means you don't follow them, is sabotaging your capacity to be awakened, because your practice will always be half-hearted. It'll always be on and off, because you don't really have a deep trust. You know, in Buddhism, the word that's often translated as faith means trust, confidence. You know, and you need to question yourself, do I really have confidence in the teachings? Do I really have confidence that the teacher's words are true? When they say things like, everyone has the capacity for awakening. Everyone who follows these teachings and practices consistently will, will advance, will mature. So that's the first doubt, which is toxic to the practitioner. The second doubt is to doubt yourself, to doubt your own capacity to awaken. And you know, we heard Milarepa talking directly about that yesterday, when we ended with his disciples saying just this: "Oh, you are so exalted. You are so special. You must be the incarnation of a past great practitioner, or a bodhisattva, or a Buddha. All we can do is, get the blessings of seeing your face and hearing your words. You know, sort of like in India, what they call darshan. You get the energy of the teacher, or many people think it's just meritorious just hearing the teachings. You know, and that's all I can do, right? And you saw Milarepa shot that down. Right? He could have said, well, this is not bad, right? This is great. They love me, adore me, they're totally reliant on me, I could probably establish a great monastery and temple, set up franchises, be incredibly successful. But he didn't say that, did he? He said, not true. He said, even saying that, you're blocking your own spiritual advancement. Right? That's what he said. So again, going back to the Buddha himself, after his great enlightenment, he said, wonder of wonders. Incredible. That within this mortal frame, is this Buddha mind. Not only, pure from the very beginning, undefiled, embracing all things and the reflection of all things, but it has within it the capacity of incredible wisdom, intelligence, capacity for omniscience. Just as a given is a quality of this mind. And again, every teacher who's come to awakening for all these generations says the same thing, attests to the same thing. And for people here to doubt they have the capacity is because they're listening to the wrong voice, right? They still trust and have confidence in their voice of their little self. You know that little self, right? It's pitiful. It's needy. Wah 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 wah. It's so sensitive. So easily its feelings get hurt. So quickly it gets resentful and angry. It worries about everything. Right. Things don't go its way. It gets angry. I mean, it's like. And that's the voice when we enter the spiritual path that we listen to. So this is a grave mistake. Right? Again, it shows, and I'm not being critical, it shows that we have no confidence, no trust in the teachings, in the path, and in the teachers. Because their voice is saying something entirely different. And if you still do not hear that voice inside you, you have not merged your mind with the Dharma. It's an expression in Buddhism. Merge your mind with the Dharma. That it not only means the realization of the Dharma, it means even before that, that the teachings of Dharma, the extreme, it's so there's so much common sense in it. And yet we don't incorporate it to hear its voice inside us, right? We still hear the voice of that, of the conditioned self, right? You know, what is the origin of this little self-doubting voice? It always is, you know, it does not, that little voice does not seek enlightenment. It does not seek liberation. It seeks what? Safety. Comfort. Right? That's what it seeks. It wants to be safe. And it always wants to feel good about itself. But because it's not real, it doesn't exist, it has to affirm that every day. It has to affirm that in every encounter. It looks for its validation. So it's endless. Anybody notice that? It's just endless. The drama, day after day. Self-drama. There is another way. And again, as is shown, you know, you can still be a beer-guzzling, wife-beating, you know. You know, I'm being humorous here. Nobody take me seriously. It's not as if you have to change your personality, change your externalities of your life around. It's just your mind. You have to change. So today, continuing with Milarepa, I'm looking at a different book, which is a translation of a text called The 100,000 Songs of Milarepa. By the way, there were not 100,000 songs of Milarepa, but there were hundreds, hundreds and hundreds. And I'm not sure why it's called 100,000 songs. Tomorrow I'll do something a little different with the songs, with the little time we have. But I just wanted to give you a little sense of kind of the way he was. Yes?
I have a question about the teachings. I appreciate your wonderful style of teaching. I feel like we're all gathered around a campfire and you tell us a wonderful story. But, but one of my questions is about Marfa.
Yeah.
One of his was about doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You presented Marfa as a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the mind of the student, and he was almost omniscient.
Mm-hmm.
But you used that word.
Mm-hmm.
And what I understood from listening to your story of Marfa is that he had something that he believed was going to bring the best out in Milarepa. He was going to remove his karmic stains, except for that one. but I heard it very differently.
Mm-hmm.
I heard him pushing this young 20-something man to the limit where he was suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason, maybe, that he didn't commit suicide under the tutelage of Mark was because of the compassion and kindness of his wife.
So you take away the story, what?
I take away the story that she's almost a footnote, but to me it's a very powerful teaching that you need compassion and kindness in order to go ahead and to teach effectively. And that Marfa could have killed him.
Well, again, there's a risk there. So again, Alex, if you ever develop yourself to the point you become a Dharma teacher, be cautious in how you push your students. All right. Do we know the actuality? No. Actually, historically, it is considered actually that. That his wife was quite a developed person in her own right, but for just whatever reason, she let Marfa run the show. And it's interesting, you know, I mean, when I was among the Tibetans, a number of the very great teachers do have wives, take wives. And many of these wives are quite wonderful. And in their own right. And you often see people off in the corner getting teachings from them. Or they'll get somebody afterwards, after the person has been with the great Lama, and she'll kind of explain what the teaching was about. So it's an interesting kind of dynamic that often works. Again, I disagree with you. I think the this is very foreign to us. This kind of encounter. You also see it in some of the Zen literature. This kind of desire for enlightenment, where one is so fanatically, wanting it, that one would risk death, and almost it becomes a life and death thing, where somebody says, if I don't achieve enlightenment tonight, I'm going to kill myself. Hopefully, that's not always the case. So, I think that's really what it's about. It's really showing that in Milarepa, Marpa saw this, he saw this jewel, right? He saw this jewel, this brightly shining jewel, and yet he also saw it was covered with dirt, right? And rather than go through a 30-year process of cleansing the dirt off the diamond, he did it fast and dirty, and it was risky, right? He was at the edge a lot. before he was at the point where, if you read the story, before he was at the point of actually, finally going, I am going to do it now. He had lots of those kinds of thoughts, lots of despair. We know he went off a couple of times, often with the help. So, yeah, don't get into the specifics of it. But the generally, it is a story of a very unusual teacher with a very unusual student, the two of them, both fanatics, both extreme, both totally devoted to a Dharma and awakening, right? And one playing the role as teacher, and one in the role of this highly energetic aspiring student, heavy karma, and his teacher just working as quick and dirty as he could to expiate it, to put him through his paces, to give him the harshest kind of training, right? We know there are in sports and other professions, some people go through very harsh training. That kind of training is not for everybody. And that kind of training may be very injurious to many. Right? But sometimes it works. Right? In this case, it worked. The way I was talking yesterday, it is considered these traditions, deep meditative traditions within Buddhism, again, which are not mainstream Buddhism, right? Where the attainment of awakening is the goal, right? You often get these kind of extreme encounters, which are often hard to understand, because the stakes are not stakes that we are used to. And the way they play for it is not what we're used to. And also to remember that compassion in Buddhism is not necessarily sweet and soft. Compassion in Buddhism, karuna, does not mean empathy. It means to be empathic to the suffering of another. That's the empathic part. And the second part is, at the same time, emerging with that empathy emerges the desire to free that individual from their suffering. And in the teachings on compassion is also called upaya. Upaya is often translated as skillful means, expedient means. Which means that the way one goes about helping somebody free themselves from suffering, whatever that is a skill, takes skillfulness, right? To devise a means that'll be effective, right? So the developing capacity and skillful means and expedient means as the expression of compassion is very much part of this tradition. But that is a whole range of competencies and skills that one develops. So one can be of more help, such as a physician with one or two medicines in their medicine bag has only limited capacity to help. But a physician who has, 100 different medicines, right, can be much more targeted, right, in terms of the individual disease entity, symptoms, et cetera, and, well, the physical makeup, et cetera, of the patient. So in the same way, a teacher who has many, 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 many means, right, to affect transformation and change and healing in the student is considered a great teacher. Now, the object is not kindness. The object is to free somebody from their suffering. So when you look at compassion in that way, it's lots of possibilities, right?
Yeah, I think that and wife is compassion that she got her husband to back off.
Yeah, but you're missing the biggest part of the story, Alex, which is Marpa's compassion to free Milarepa from his suffering, and all you can say is he did it, and Milarepa, we know, he did not sing a song without praising his teacher. Now that should tell you something. Right? I mean, that should tell you something. Because, even though I can tell your empathy is going out for the victim, there's no victim here. Everybody was happy. Everybody lived happily ever after. And Milarepa did not hold it against Marpa that he drove him to extremity. He bowed to him. He endlessly offered praise. Thank you. And that's that's the wonder of the story. I'm saying this is extreme. This is not normal behavior. I mean, Marpa is a very unusual Dharma teacher. Milarepa was a very unusual Dharma student, and therefore their whole interchange was very unusual. But within that interchange, within the story, there are many truths that are relevant to us that we can understand. And it breaks us out of our mold. Because again, I said right in the beginning, we want our teachers to be like Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, right? We like that. They're just the way we want them. They're bright, they're funny, right? They're wise.
Just like you.
You know what I'm saying? They're old. And along comes Marpa, It's like, right? I mean, Milarepa went right by him when he passed him in the field. He sees this corpulent guy out there drinking beer, and he goes, I hear there's a famous lama around here. Can you direct him to me? And Marpa plays along. Yeah, he lives up there. Yeah. Here, have some beer. Right? So it's again, these teaching stories are meant to also break us out of our attachments, our views. And again, we see in Marpa that the bottom line is he was a great teacher with his students. That was the bottom line. And whether his extended family thought he was just a nut, right? And whether all the neighbors, as they see all these people streaming to his home, because again, Marpa was unusual. He didn't live in a monastery. I mean, he was in this tradition of lay teachers where he sort of turned his home into his kind of temple. People came to his home. And the neighbors are going, they must be going, why are people going to see him? Right? I mean, every time we always hear him screaming at his wife, drinking beer half the time, and you run into him in the neighborhood, and he's not very nice, But he was a great teacher, which is, again, what this is about. So what I'd like to get through with us today are kind of two stories that actually have three stories. Just I want to give you a flavor of what an extraordinary teacher Milarepa was and how he taught. So I thought I'd do this one only because this, those of you maybe who've been looking at this, and this is just a little kind of folk painting that I picked up in Tibetan settlement in India, you know, in the nearly 40 years ago, I guess. And I've just had it for years. And actually had it up in my kids' room when they were little. And then, all of a sudden I just remembered it the other day. It was put away. So this is the story of Milarepa, the huntsman, and the deer. So those of you wondering what's going on there, that's a hunter, that's his dog, his hunting dog, and that's a deer, and that's Milarepa in his cave. So Milarepa is a time he's up in a secluded place on the border between Nepal and Tibet. And this is quite beautiful. Give you a sense of where he lived. The upper slopes were very rugged, cloudy, foggy, and continuously deluged with rain. To the right of the mountain towered a precipitous hill where one could always hear the cries of wild animals and watch vultures hovering above. To its left stood a hill clothed with soft, luxuriant meadows where deer and antelope played. Below there was a luxurious forest with all kinds of trees and flowers, and within which lived many monkeys, peacocks, turkeys, and other beautiful birds. The monkeys amused themselves by swinging and leaping among the trees. The birds darted here and there with a great display of wing, while warblers chirped and sang. In front of the hermitage flowed a stream, fed by melting snow and filled with rocks and boulders. A fresh, clear, bubbling sound could always be heard as one passed by. Not bad. It was a quiet and delightful place with every favorable condition for devotees. And it was here that the Jetsun Milarepa indulged in the river flow samadhi, while all the benevolent local deities rendered him services and oblations. Okay, so here he is dwelling in this beautiful place. One day he hears a dog barking, and then a great noise. Milarepa thinks, hitherto this place has been very favorable for meditation. What's going on? He left the cage, went to a huge rock, and sat upon it absorbed in the compassion of non-discrimination. Before long, a black, many-spotted deer ran up, frightened. Seeing this, compassion arose within Milarepa, and he feels sad for it. He sees it as suffering because it's running for something. So he says it's so pitiful. He feels, takes compassion. But it's interesting, he's pitiful that a being has been born in this form of a deer and is subject to such fear. So he says, I will preach to him the Dharma of the Mahayana and lead him to eternal bliss. So Milarepa would share his Dharma with all beings, not just human beings. Listen to me, and I'm skipping the introduction where he bows to Marpa, Alex. He bows to the feet of Marpa, not to Marpa's wife. Listen to me, you deer with sharp antlers. Because you want to escape from something in the outer world, you have no chance to free yourself from inner blindness and delusions. With no regret or sadness, forget your mind and outer body. The time has come for you to renounce all blindness and delusion. The ripening karma is fearful and compelling, but how can you escape from it by fleeing with your delusory body? If you want to escape, hide within your mind essence. If you want to run away, flee to the place of enlightenment. There is no other place of safe refuge. Uprooting all confusion from your mind, stay with me here and rest in quiet. At this very moment, the fear of death is full upon you. You're thinking safety lies on the far side of the hill. If I stay here, I'll get caught. This fear and hope is why you wander in samsara. I will now teach you. Very beautiful and very points to the human condition. I mean, he's, again, all these songs, you know. Again, the deer is scared, it's being chased, and it thinks safety lies in what? Getting to the other side of the hill. And Milarepa said, that's it. Right? Beings are always trying to escape their misery within the context of samsara, right? What does he think? What's going to happen on the other side of the hill? There are no hunters, there are no dogs, there's no danger. Right? And that's us. We're always thinking, human beings are always thinking, what? If I just get this, then everything will be good. Right? If I just get that, everything will be good. If this, I can get this thing to change in my life, get this piece of furniture, get this, new that, new whatever, right? Then I'll be happy. Then we get over there, and then what happens? Something else, and something else, and something else. So it's quite wonderful. Affected by Jetson's compassion, the deer was relieved from its painful fear of capture. With tears streaming down its eyes, it came near to Milarepa, licked his clothes, and lay down at his side. Just at that moment, a large red bitch with a black tail, that's a female dog, by the way, and color, a black tail with a collar around her neck, ran toward him. She was a hunting dog, savage, fearful creature, her tongue hanging out like a blazing ribbon, sharp claws on her feet that could rend any prey, and her threatening growl was like thunder. Ferocious Milarepa saw it. She's full of anger. Whatever she sees, she regards as her enemy. It would be good if I could calm her and quench her hatred. Great pity for the bitch. I'll say dog. I think the person who translated this was kind of looked it up in the dictionary and saw a female dog bitch. You know, this was translated by Garma C.C. Chang. He was not a native English speaker. Great pity for the dog arose in him, and he sang with great compassion. And again, he sings a song, "Oh, you so-and-so with a wolf's face, listen to my song. Whatever you see, you deem it to be your foe. Your heart is full of hatred and ill thoughts. Because of your bad karma, you were born in this condition. Ever you suffer from hunger, always agonized by a passion." Anybody know dogs like this? They're always stirred up. It doesn't take much for them to growl and bark. Right. All they want to do is bite people. You know dogs like that?
I think it's just...
What?
What? You thought it was like...
Don't. Not everything's about you. If you do not try to catch the self-mind within, what good is it to catch the prey outside? The time has come for you to capture your own true mind. Now is the time to renounce your fury, and with me sit here restfully. Your mind is full of greed and anger, thinking, if I go that way, I'll lose him. But if I catch him, if I go forward on the side, this is the same hope and fear that as you wander in samsara. Let me teach you. So again, the dog was greatly moved. Her fury subsided. She made signs to Milarepa by whining, wagging her tail, licking his clothes. She put her muzzle under her two front paws and prostrated herself before him. Tears fell from her eyes, and she lay down peacefully with the deer. And then Milarepa saw there must be some evil person following these two animals. And sure enough, in a minute a man appeared very proud and violent. From under his lashes, his eyes glared fiercely. His hair was knotted at the top of his head, and his long sleeve flapped from side to side as he ran. In one hand he had a bow and arrow, in the other hand a long lasso for catching game. His breath came in suffocating gas, and streams of sweat poured down his face, almost choking him to death. When he came and he saw the dog and the deer next to Milarepa, he thought, are they bewitched by this yogi? He then cried angrily to Milarepa, "You fat, greasy repas and yogis, I see you hair there everywhere, high in the mountains. You come to kill my game. Low in the lakeshore, you come to cook my fish. On the plains, you visit town to trade in dogs and fight with people. Does not matter if one or two you like, you die. You may have the power of keeping my dog and my deer, but now see whether your clothes can keep out of my arrow. So he pulled back and he shot at him. But the arrow went high and missed. Then Milarepa thought, if even ignorant animals can understand my preaching, this man should be able to do so too. So he said to him, you don't need to be in a hurry to shoot me. You have plenty of time. You can do it later. In the meantime, I have a song to sing to you. You man with a human body, but a demon's face. See, he's fearless. Right? He's fearless, Milarepa, right? I mean, this is a rough character. Right? Shoots at him. And Milarepa, unruffled. Come, let me teach you Dharma. Men say the human body is most precious like a gem, but there's nothing precious about you. You sinful man with a demon's look, though you desire the pleasures of this life because of your evil doing, you'll never gain them. If you renounce desires within, you will win the great accomplishment. It is difficult to conquer oneself when vanquishing the outer world. Conquer now your own self-mind. To slay this deer will never please you. But if you kill the four poisons within, all your wishes will be fulfilled. If one tries to vanquish foes in the outer world, they only increase. If one conquers one's own mind within, all one's foes will disappear. Do not spend your life committing evil deeds. It is good for you to practice the Dharma. I will now teach you. So the hunter listened, and he thought, but there's nothing to prove what he just said is true. Usually a deer is very frightened, and usually my dog is wild and savage. Today they lie peacefully together, like a mother and her sons. Hitherto I never missed a shot during my winter hunting in the snow mountains. But today I couldn't hit him. He must either be a black magician or a very great and unusual lama. I will find out how he lives. So he's interested. He went in the cave, he looked around, he couldn't find anything, just some inedible herbs. And all of a sudden, seeing the evidence of such austerity, a great faith suddenly arose in him. So even though he is so coarse, this being, right? There's something in not only Milarepa's words, but in his energy, and when he sees the way he lives, he realizes what this man is pure. Right? There's nothing here. He lives totally alone. There's no gold hidden. He doesn't have stacks. He's true. Right? He's pure. He's an unusual being. And even this very rough character kind of felt something. So he says, Reverend teacher, who is your teacher? And what teachings do you practice? Where do you come from? Who are your companions? What do you own? And if I am acceptable to you, I would like to be your servant. Also, I will offer you the life of this deer. And so it's interesting, and there are lots of stories like this. I mean, if you ever do reading on your own, it's sort of like the Buddha. You know, if you read the life of the Buddha, you know, as the Buddha traveled around, just wandering around teaching, we know everywhere he went, people just followed him, right? It was very interesting. I mean, people would just, you know, pack up and go with him. I want to be with you. All of a sudden, they saw another hallway, and they saw someone who was practicing that way, and all of a sudden, their other whole life and all the things they were doing seemed superficial or no longer concerned them at all, and there was something so genuine and meaningful about the Buddha that people immediately followed him. And here you see the same thing, right? I mean, you know, the huntsman saying, if I'm acceptable to you, I would like to be your servant. So then he sings a song about his guru, his teacher, da-dum-da-dum, da-dum-da-dum. It's very sweet. The snow, the rocks, and the clay mountains, the three are where Mila meditates. If you they satisfied, you may come with me. The deer and the antelope are the Buddha's, are Milarepa's cattle. If they satisfy, you may come with me. The lynx, the wild dog, the wolf, these three are Mila's witch dogs, watchdogs. If they satisfy, you may come with me. And he goes on like that. The sun, the moon, and the stars, these three are Mila's pictures. If they satisfy, you would come with me. The hyena, the ape, and the monkey, these three are Mila's playmates. If they satisfy, you may come with me. Bliss, illumination, and non-thought, these three are my companions. If you they satisfy, you may come with me. Porridge, roots, and nettles, these three are Mila's food. If they satisfy, you may come with me. Water from snow and spring and brook, these three are Mila's drink. If they satisfy, you may come with me. And then it goes on and on and on. So, and actually, at the end, this man, the hunter's name was Chiwawa Gyumbo Dorje. He gave him the complete initiation and pith instructions. So practicing them, the huntsman eventually became one of the heart sons of Milarepa and was known as Chira Repa, the cotton-clad huntsman. The deer and the dog were also forever removed from the path of sorrows. It is said that the bow and arrows which the huntsman offered to Milarepa are still in that cave. So that is the story of Milarepa. And now I want to read to you the Shepherd's Search for Mind. So again, please notice, you know, first you have a hunter, and now you have a shepherd. So these are also many of the people that Milarepa taught. Again, that is one of the reasons he's so loved. I mean, if you go through, as he taught all kinds of people. I mean, he taught yogis, he taught monks, he taught nuns, he taught rich people, aristocrats, right? But he also taught, you know, common, untutored, unlettered people. But it's interesting. You know, I think in those days you might go, wow. But you know, in a place like Tibet, where people had these kind of vocations, like a shepherd, you spend lots of time alone. Right? And in Tibet, you know, if you've ever been there or seen pictures, there's a great vastness of sky and land and mountains and plains, you know, that I think makes the mind very open and uncluttered. And so I think there was a reason that it was so easy in a certain way for people to go, wow, you know, I get this. And also because people didn't have that much. You know, there was much, you know, I mean, we have so much more stuff. We're so attached to our stuff. And we live at such a high level off, you know, away from the natural world. You know, going to live in a cave or something seems, you know, so totally far removed. But if you go to these countries, you realize, again, not that, you know, living in a cave is not different, but it's not so far removed from the way ordinary people lived. So this actually, this has two stories in it. The first one, and I thought just to give you a sense of how he dealt with just an ordinary married couple. So, you know, as you know, part of his, you know, he would spend long periods of time in meditation, but then when he ran out of food and stores, again, we know at some point there was that whole period when he lived on nettles and became green, that for years he didn't. He vowed not to go down. But a lot of his time, you know, in the spring and summer, he would go down into the valleys and, you know, visit villages and gather food that he would then, he and his followers would then take up in the fall up into the mountains, their caves, and so they would have food, you know, for 6 months of the year or 9 months of the year. So he's in a village. He's in the happy village of Mong Yul. And among them was a married couple who had no children. They invited him to their house. They served him. And again, this is very common. You know, you would invite a teacher to your house. You'd offer them food. And then after the meal, you might ask them some questions of Dharma. And dear Lama, where are your home and your relatives? And he says, I am a poor beggar who has disavowed his relatives and native land, but has also been forsaken by them. And the couple cried, in that case, we'd like to adopt you into our family. We have a good strip of land which we can give you. You can then marry an attractive woman, and soon you will have relatives. And Milarepa said, I have no need of these things, and let me tell you why. He sings the song. Home and land at first seem pleasant, but they are like a rasp, filing away one's body and mind. Anybody ever felt like their home owns them? Okay? Home and land at first seem pleasant, but they are like a rasp, filing away one's body, word, and mind. How toilsome plowing and digging can become. And then the seeds you planted never sprout. You work for naught. In the end, it becomes a land of misery, desolate and unprotected. In such a prison of tree. And he says, when I think of a house restoring, he says, I have no wish to join your family. And they say, well, please don't talk like that. We'll find you a fine girl from a prominent family who is fit to be your bride and will suit you. He sang. At first, the lady is like a heavenly angel. The more you look at her, the more you want to gaze. Middle age, she becomes a demon with corpse's eyes. You say one word to her, and she shouts back too. She pulls your hair and hits your knee. You strike her with your staff, but back she throws the ladle. At life's end, she becomes an old cow with no teeth. Her angry eyes burn with a devilish fire, penetrating deep into your heart. I keep away from women to avoid fights and quarrels. For the young bride you mentioned, I have no appetite. So the husband says, dear Lama, it's true that when one grows old, close to death, one hasn't the same capacity for enjoying life or being pleasant as when one young. But if I have no son, my grief and disappointment will be unbearable. How about you? Don't you need a son? Right. Milarepa is saying, in youth, a son is like the prince of heaven. You love him so much that the passion is hard to bear. In middle age, he becomes a ruthless creditor to whom you give all, but he still wants more. Driven from the house or his own parents, invited in is his beloved, charming lady. The father calls, but he won't answer. Sounds somewhat familiar, right? His mother cries out, but he doesn't listen. Then the neighbors take advantage, spreading lies and rumors. Thus I learn that one's child oft becomes one's enemy. Bearing this in mind, I renounce the fetters of samsara. For sons and nephews, I have no... And then they say, okay, maybe true, but how about a daughter? Right? So he says, in youth, the daughter is like a smiling heavenly angel. She is more attractive and precious than her jewels. In her middle age, she's good for nothing. Before her father, she openly carries things away from the house. She pilfers secretly behind her mother's back. If her parents don't praise her and satisfy her wants, they suffer from her bitterness and temper. In the end, she becomes red-faced and wields a sword. At her best, she may serve and devote herself to others. At her worst, she'll bring mishaps and disasters. A troublemaker. I have no appetite for this. Then they go on, relatives. And then they said, all right, how about But can't we just give you, all right, you know, they said, we get it, you know, you don't want any of these relations, but can't we just give you some land? You know, we want to at least give you some wealth so you can be secure. And he says, wealth at first leads to self-enjoyment, making other people envious. However much one has, one never feels it's enough until one is bound by the miser's demon. It is hard to spend it on virtuous deeds. Wealth provokes enemies and stirs up ghosts. One works hard to gather riches which others will spend. In the end, one struggles for life and death to amass wealth and money, but all it does is invite enemies. So I renounce the whole thing. These songs gave these people an unshakable faith in Milarepa, and they gave away all their possessions for the sake of the Dharma. They began to practice his teachings and were forever released from falling into the lower realms. When they died, they entered the path of awakening and step by step approached Buddhahood. People just got it, didn't they? Wow. Any question before we go to the next story? What?
Well, it just seems sort of extreme. Also,
he's extreme. He's extreme. He's a yogi. He doesn't want any part of it. Right? And there's something about that. You see, there's something about that tradition. Because there is some truth in what he says. There is some truth, right? If anybody's ever raised a son or a daughter, they know they are not always sources of bliss for you, right? 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 They can become sources of suffering for you, right? And if you say, Diane, well, that's not what's happened with my children, well, then you know it's happened with other children. So you know there's a truth in what he says. There's a deep truth in what he says, the way things turned out. And so he's extreme because he's a yogi, right? You know, it's like, you know, people sometimes read these old monastic teachings about women. Have you ever read them? Well, they're just horrible, you know, horrible, horrible. There's descriptions of the utter venality of women, I mean, for everything. And then it goes into their bodies and how disgusting their bodies are. And, you know, and women go, what? You know, in this day and age. But you've got to understand that these were written at a time for monks who had taken a vow of celibacy. And so if you're a monk taking a vow of celibacy, obviously these kinds of teachings kind of help enforce that absolute, non-desire for women. That's what those teachings were for. They weren't for lay people. But, you know, without the commentary, one doesn't understand it, and one goes, wow, how misogynist, you know, these people were. But they really weren't. I mean, it could create that, but that's, so it's always the context. Diane, if you had taken the vow to live your whole life in caves, right, enduring incredible hardship and privation, right? You have to be very clear in your mind that there is nothing out there that you want, that has any attraction for you at all, right? I mean, can you think about the mindset of somebody who does that? So this is, you know, so this is where he's at. And he just teaches his truth. Now, again, you may say that's extreme, but I think if you're honest, and not just look at, you look at the general picture, you can see lots of truth. There are lots of children who cause suffering to their parents. There are lots of children who steal from their parents and take from their parents and demand. There are lots of children that are ungrateful, right? Are there not? And so you can say there's a truth here, right? He talks about wealth and he goes, you know, it becomes a, you know, your home becomes a burden, you know. People joke that way, right? You know, right? You know, I work so hard to pay my mortgage, Right? Why are you working so hard to pay my mortgage? You know, right? The house owns you. So there's truth in what he says. And, you know, we don't like it. But, we have to be willing to what? To be open to it and see the truth in it. Because, we may not be ready to follow him to the cave, but we may be willing to modify our behavior. Right? If we see truth.
Yes.
The Buddha, after practicing asceticism and austerity for several years,
mm-hmm.
adopted the middle way, mm-hmm. as I understand it.
Right.
I know that the Buddha, that Milarepa is not following an ascetic path just for the sake of austerity itself. He's
right.
following it so he can practice the Dharma.
Right.
But nonetheless, the teachings of the Buddha, again, as I understand it, don't demand that kind of extreme austerity or renunciation. It's not a path of renunciation.
Well, again, that's semi-true. I mean, I think actually the first thing you said was more accurate, which was, in India at that time, still to the day, the path of asceticism, the path of bodily denial or bodily torture, was seen as a path to spiritual growth. Okay. So that was what the Buddha was following. Okay. And he clearly reached the point where he realized, this just leads to exhaustion, right? This just leads to perturbation. This just leads to weariness. There is nothing ennobling about this path. So the path of austerity, or asceticism as a spiritual path in and of itself is what he clearly renounced. Okay. But you see, in his life, it was a fairly ascetic path, the Buddha's life. I mean, he had maybe two robes. He had no home, right? He every day begged for his food. He didn't store up anything. Right, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think from householder standards, it was an ascetic life, right? The only thing you could say about it is it he did it kind of in the public arena. I mean, he was very much going in society. What you see here is kind of an offshoot of that, which is again, I think the point is, like you said, Milarepa is not following a path of asceticism for the sake of asceticism. He's following an ascetic path because these teachings, and again, you need to understand, and this was explained to me very clearly by my teachers in the Tibetan tradition, that these yogic teachings, right, demand for success this type of intensity, this type of consistency over time. So to get success with these types of practices like he was doing, you need to be removed from all distraction and all other activities. They have to be practiced single-mindedly. And that's what they were doing. in the hierarchy of ascetics, he was extreme. Often in India or Asia or other places, it was very traditional, let's say, near many monasteries in the meditative tradition. The monastery is here. And up in the mountain behind the monastery live retreatants. They live in little retreat houses, or they may live in caves. But they're, a two-hour walk up the mountain, or a four-hour walk. They are close by, and they're often taken care of, the food and everything. So it's an asceticism, but it's not as extreme as Milarepa, right? Or somebody, often hermits or something would just live outside the villages alone. So it was, but in the hierarchy, Milarepa is the big leagues, right? So, I think that's what's extraordinary about him and the extremity, but that again, it's interesting because I mean, these Buddhist cultures and some of the Asian cultures were very interesting. And maybe it was also true in Europe at some point, I think, too, maybe in the early days of Christianity. But there was a, even though the majority of society was involved in, you know, householder life, trade, you know, accumulation, you know, business, occupation of whatever it was, there was an understanding that these people who devoted themselves, you know, we are in a, you know, in a Catholic retreat center of, you know, the Franciscan St. Francis. You know, there was an understanding that, you know, that people who devote themselves single-mindedly to a religious or spiritual path and live outside the norms, right, were greatly respected, were supported, right? So you could see, you know, if you read the story of Milarepa, you see many people would come up to his caves carrying, you know, offerings, carrying food for them. Or when he'd come down into the valleys, they would, you know, they would see, you know, this is a wonderful being, and they would give, you know, alms and offerings to them. So there was a sense that of society that these people play a valuable role. You know, it may not be my path, but knowing that they're there, right, practicing so seriously, devoting themselves, supports me, even though I am, you know, a householder. Right? Because it's a shining light. And again, he's uncompromised. He tells it like it is. And Diane goes, no, my son's good to me. My daughter's good to me. Just you wait.
The point that there is pleasure and pain. I mean, it's not all suffering and pain. It's both.
Yeah, and but again, he is talking absolute renunciation of all this pleasure, pain, success, failure, good, bad life. He is devoting himself single-mindedly to the meditative life, to the cultivation of awareness, great bliss. I mean, you know, total freedom. Right? I mean, that's his path. Okay, so we, again, that's, you know, that's what I'm saying. Please understand that for many of us living here in the West, it sounds all very strange. And it is kind of strange. But, I mean, having seen it myself in my travels to Asia, it's kind of wonderful. I mean, I have to say that in generally, the happiest people I met were people in retreat. And again, when you think about retreat, it doesn't always mean walled off in a cave. I mean, there were many places like in Tibet or in India where just people, retreatants, would kind of gather in an area, like in a mountain. And there could be 100 of them. You know, some of them living up here in this cave, and some of them built a little house here, and you know what I mean? And they all live like in a community, and you can go visit with them. I mean, they're fairly isolated, but if you get up to their cave, and you come in, they greet you. They have nothing, but they offer you whatever little nothing they have. And generally, it was very striking to me that in general they just seemed very happy. You know, they were free. And again, it may not be our path, but it's nice to know they're there. And that people, you know, we, right, who think we need so much to be happy, right, who are working so hard to get all the things, you know, that we need to be happy, and making sure, you know, that we need the latest restaurant, and we need the latest kitchen gadget, and we need vacations, and we need savings account. You know, we need, right, to encounter people who have none of that, who are happy, peaceful. You know, I mean, it makes you stop and think. So they do play a role. Yes.
I have, I can absolutely respect the path he's chosen. I can see why the people surrounding would respect the path. And the teaching on wealth certainly seems like truth. But what bothers me is his utter disdain for humans and humans in relation to each other. He can renounce that as necessary to his own path. But it suggests sort of, I don't see the compassion in it, and it certainly suggests that it's rather selfish.
Well, I understand you see it that way. And that's one way to see it. But it sort of ties in, I think, with what I said earlier about compassion. Okay? And it's different than what we're used to. If you think about compassion as having the active role of wanting to free the suffering person from their suffering. If you look around and you see people acting stupidly, if you see people working hard and diligently for no end, right? If you see them involved in pursuits that are essentially meaningless and fruitless and only in, you know, are just a continuation, you may point it out. And in this case, you may point it out quite directly and harshly. But that doesn't mean that he's full of hate for human beings. If you read the text, you see he's actually quite wonderful and quite well-loved. As you heard in Alex's question, Alex would, when Alex finally escaped from Marper, he'd resent him for the rest of his life. I can't believe, But we have to say Milarepa didn't, did he? Right? And we saw, the fascinating thing about the story with Marper is up to a certain point you see this harshness with Milarepa. And then on a dime, he's this sweet, loving, supportive man, right? Only wanting to help him, right? So that should make you think, maybe it's not as I think it is, right? So I understand. I mean, I'm not asking you to do anything with this, but just take it in and go, maybe things are a little different than I think. Maybe things aren't as I appear. And really, what is compassion? In the Judeo-Christian tradition, right? You have many of the great prophets saying terrible things about their people, right? Condemning them up and down, right? And these are considered the great prophets. You have Christ, going into the temple and driving out the money changers, right? Quite forcibly. So, sometimes religious teachers, spiritual teachers have to, act quite strongly. Because sentient beings are unruly. They're unruly. They're just full of themselves. Right? And they act in such terrible ways to each other. And yet they think it's okay. So, some teachers appear in this life in a very mild, soft, caring way, but others, appear quite wrathful. Right? You have a child. Do you never say a harsh word to your child? Do you ever say no to her? Do you ever have to chastise her? Good. You can't always be sweet and nice, can you? And hopefully when you are chastising her quite firmly, you're not doing it from personal anger, you're doing it to benefit her. Because you understand that that soft, kind, understanding way isn't working, right? And she needs it. And it's like that. It's like that. That's, do you still love your daughter? Right. You're doing it why? Why are you acting so kind of wrathful with her?
For her own benefit.
For her own benefit. Okay. You get it? Yes, Sally.
I just wanted to add to what you were saying about the people living in the caves up in India. And I had that experience of meditating with the holy man in the caves, going up by myself where they would invite me to have some chai with them and join them for meditation. And what I realized, not only did the culture there respect that and appreciate it, but it's like there was an energy, a sacred energy in that whole area where I think the world benefited from, even though that lifestyle is extreme, but it had a lot of benefits that I think our culture doesn't appreciate, doesn't understand.
So just for the record, Sally's just sharing experience of being in India and visiting some holy people in a cave, and how wonderful that was and sacred that was. And she's saying, that just that they're there is benefiting the world and all humankind. And that's really the belief. I mean, in Buddhism, if someone says, you know, I want to go off and live in a cave and just devote myself to meditation and my own healing and transformation, that's not considered a selfish act. Right? Because if they're not saying, I'm going off because I'm, Milarepa is not saying, this place is so vile, human beings are so vile, I want nothing to do with them, I'm going to go off and live by myself. You see? That's just ego, right? And that's really, hatred or something, or I hate human beings. There are people like that. They hate human beings. I want nothing to do with them, right? But that's not like that. Because one sees this whole book is filled with what? These are all filled with the stories of Milarepa's interaction with human beings in a very compassionate, helpful way. So we see there is an interaction that traditionally goes on. But if you ask Milarepa, how did you come to your realization? He says it's because of all those years I spent alone, cultivating the meditative life. And so, the Buddha himself, from his leaving of his home and his family and his kingdom, to his awakening, he spent 6 years meditating with different teachers, studying, practicing. And that led to, that led to his great awakening, the process. So if somebody is serious about meditation and their own self-transformation and wants to work on their own self-cultivation in private, and they're serious. That's wonderful, That's very beneficial because we benefit from what they're doing, and hopefully, if they do achieve enlightenment from it, we will benefit when they have the capacity to teach. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, we benefit from that. The world benefits. Right? I mean, right now there are thousands of people in medical school doing nothing, right? Doing nothing of social value, right? But the hope is at the end of 15 years they'll be of social value, right? So we put up with their selfishness. Right? So we understand that, right? We understand that people, to develop a skill and real competency, you have to, spend time cultivating your craft. It doesn't just happen. And so in other areas, we understand, that a music student, maybe has to study and practice for 10 or 15 years before they, are really, really wonderful at what they do, right? And so we give them that time. Well, also in this world of spiritual transformation and cultivation, you know, you have to give people 10, 15, 20, 30 years before they're really capable. Last one, because I want to get to the shepherd.
Very brief. I was just struck by the contrast between this time last year, listening to stories about Bhante.
Oh, Bhante.
And simply realize you're unborn and moving mind. Now you don't need to do all this.
Mm-hmm.
And Brother Rapa,
yeah,
who demonstrates this incredible focus and diligence in this meditative tradition.
Yeah.
They're both there.
Both there. Yeah. So for the record, Ken is just going, a year ago, he was at retreat here. We did Bhante. Bhante is just right, you know, your unborn Buddha mind. Here it is. Realize it, live in it, and that's all there is to do. And here you have Milarepa with this very intense, delineated path of step by step and these very kind of complicated practices. And yeah, that's the wonder of Dharma. All right, so let me... I do want to get... Well, I, all right. So anyhow, again, we know that couple had unshakable faith and they gave away all their possessions for the sake of the Dharma and they just practiced. And again, let me just say, when I was in Tibet, in India, I met lots of Tibetans. I met some. Couples just like that. Couples just like that. It's not that uncommon. So now, one day, he returned to his cave at Raghmere, and he remained there, and he was in an inspired mood. Interesting. I mean, he seems to be inspired most of the time, so the fact that they say that he was in an inspired mood up there. One day, two young shepherds showed up, and they started having a conversation with them. I won't go into it with this time. They asked some kind of Dharma questions, these two young shepherds. And the elder boy goes, I don't know, I don't think this guy has anything to help us with. But the younger one says to Milarepa, after this cute Milarepa had said a couple of things, the younger one goes, do you mean that consciousness is mind itself and that the physical body is the house of the mind? Interesting question, shepherd. And Milarepa says, yes, that's correct. The boy continued, we know that although a house usually belongs to only one person, many people can enter it. So we always find a number of people living in a house. In the same way, is there one mind in the body, or are there many? If there are many, how do they all live together? Interesting question. That conversation this yogi is having with these shepherds. Now listen to Milarepa's answer. Well, as to whether there is only one mind in the body or many, you had better find that out for yourself. Okay, so here's the master. Right? He turns it around. Right? Good question. Find the answer. Because if Milarepa just gives him the answer, it's just an intellectual, it's a concept. Right? But if the shepherd understands these things himself, he can have real transformation understanding. So he says, good question, find that out. And the boy says, revered one, I'll try. So the boys took their leave and went home. Next morning, the younger boy returned. By the way, he's only 15 years old. He's a shepherd, right? Completely unlettered, untutored. Probably can't read, write. Spends his time herding the sheep and the yaks. In the summer, he's down the summer, he's up in the mountains. In the winter, he's down in the valleys. He just follows his herd. Next morning, he returns. Dear Lama, last night I tried to find out what my mind is and how it works. I observed it carefully and found that I have only one mind. And even though one wants to, one cannot kill this mind. However one wishes to dismiss it, it will not go away. If one tries to catch it, it cannot be grasped, nor can it be held by pressing it. If you want it to remain, it will not stay. If you release it, it will not go. You try to gather it up, it can't be picked up. You try to see it, it cannot be seen. You try to understand it, it cannot be known. If you think it is an existing entity and cast it off, it won't leave you. If you think that it's non-existent, you feel it running on. It is something illuminating, aware, wide awake, yet incomprehensible. In short, it's hard to say what the mind really is. Please be kind enough to explain the meaning of the mind. Now, this may be familiar to some of you who've been doing these meditations, right? These are not unknown to us. But it's interesting. Right? He just gives it to a shepherd boy. And the shepherd boy, untutored in meditation, but takes the question seriously. Right? That's the difference, right? All night he thinks about this. All night he watches his mind. You know, do I have a mind? And how many minds do I have? You know, and you know, what happens? You know, can I grab the mind? Can I see the mind? Can I drop the mind? Can I pick it up? Right? So Milarepa sings a song. Listen to me, dear shepherd, the protector of sheep. By merely hearing about sugar's taste, sweetness cannot be experienced. Though one's mind may understand what sweetness is, it cannot experience it directly. Only the tongue can know it. In the same way, one cannot see in full the nature of mind, though one may have had glimpse of it. Perhaps it's been pointed out by others. If one relies not on this one glimpse, but continues searching for the nature of mind, eventually you will see it in the end. Dear shepherd, in this way you should observe your mind. Again, a teaching not unknown to many of us here. What is he saying? Just thinking about it, reading about it, hearing about it, it does not give you the experience of knowing this mind. In the same way, reading about, talking about, thinking about sweetness is not the same as having sugar on your tongue. When sugar is on your tongue, you know the nature of sweetness, and it cannot be put in words. It's something you know. And he's saying this to this boy. So don't just, he said, you know, he brought this teaching directly pointing to the nature of mind from India. Who brought Buddhism? Thank you. Who brought Buddhism to Tibet? People like Padmasambhava, let's say. He was what? Well, he was he was from northern, but right. So, yeah. So very much, you find within Tibetan Buddhism teachings that are
It was a mistake to think they're different.
Well, again, it's more complicated than that. It's just that they're in Tibetan Buddhism, as opposed to... the unique thing about Tibetan Buddhism was the transmission between India and Tibet was very pure. Because one, they were very, they were contiguous with each other. And what happened, is that there was a whole period over hundreds of years in which many Indian Buddhist masters went to Tibet, and many Tibetans came down to India to study. So, like you saw with Marpa, right? But this was several hundred years after Buddhism it came. He did three trips to India. And in India, he studied with Indian Buddhist teachers. For him, it was more this yogic tradition. And he found many teachings that he carried back with him, texts that he translated. He studied, and so, in a certain sense, by the 8th century, Indian Buddhism was very elaborate, and was very, was really had become very much Vajrayana. I mean, the whole tantric kind of Buddhism had been added on, as opposed to just Theravada and Mahayana. There was now the Vajrayana, so it was a much more embroidered system of practice. And so that's got that got transmitted very directly. So in a certain sense, the full breadth of Buddhism got into Tibet. So it's all very, while you find in a lot of other countries, just various traditions and lineages got transmitted. So that's why, again, you know, in Buddhism, as you go from country to country, outwardly a lot of it seems very different. But when you start getting into the teachings, you see a lot of similarity. Okay, so dear shepherd, observe your mind in this way. Continue searching for the nature of mind. Don't just rely on one glimpse. The boy then said, if you could please give me the pointing out instruction, which means it's a specific kind of teaching to point out the nature of mind to the student, this evening I'll look into it and I'll return tomorrow and tell you the result. So this is a no-nonsense kind of guy, right? I mean, you know, meets Milarepa. Milarepa says, you know, ask him a question. Milarepa says, you just observe your mind. You come back in the morning and tell me. That kid stays up all night investigating his mind, comes back the next day, gives Milarepa the results. Milarepa says, good, but you got to really continue with this and this. Kid says what? He's like a teenager, right? They go right for it. They don't hold back. All right, give me it. You know, give me instructions and I'll go home and do it. You know, he's a teenager. He's full of confidence. Right? Teenagers what? They think they can do anything, right? You know, right? They think they can do anything. So yeah, all right. And I'll be back tomorrow to give you the results. I mean, he doesn't even need a week. No. Very well. When you get home, try to find out the color of your mind. Is it white, red, or what? What is its shape? Is it oblong, round, or what? Also, try to locate where in your body it dwells. So this is very much, again, these very pith teachings. The same way there are the pith teachings about the self, there are pith teachings, you know, what is the mind? Right? Everybody here says what? I mean, common people, we all say what? I have a mind. Does everybody, this is the way people talk, right? People say, I have a mind. People talk about something in my mind. Okay. Right? So this is the way ordinary people talk, like we have something called a mind. So Milarepa says, all right, when you go home tomorrow, you know, if you have a mind, then tell me what color it is. And what is its shape? And where does it dwell? Right? Most people will say, oh, my mind is where? People point to their heads. Here's my mind. You know, if there's one thing that drives me crazy, people point to their heads. All right. So the next morning, the sun rose. The shepherd, he's still working. He comes up with his sheep, right? He's not even on retreat. Most of us, we have to go retreat and put our jobs down. He comes with all his sheep, right? And Milarepa says to him, as they are surrounded by sheep. If you can imagine, he's out, probably outside his cave on the ledge. The boy comes up, and all around the sheep are by. How do sheep sound? You don't know. Okay. He said, did you try last night to find out what your mind is like? And the boy says, yes, I did. And so Milarepa says, what does it look like? And the boy says, it is limpid, lucid, moving, unpredictable, ungraspable. It has no color or shape. When it associates with the eyes, it sees. With the ear, it hears. With the nose, it smells. With the tongue, it tastes and talks. And with the feet, it walks. If the body is agitated, the mind is stirred. Normally, the mind directs the body. When the body is in good condition, the mind can command it at will. But when the body becomes old, decayed, or bereft, the mind will leave it behind without a thought, as one throws away a stone after cleaning oneself. The mind is very realistic and adaptable. On the other hand, the body does not remain quiet or submissive, but frequently gives trouble to the mind. It causes suffering and pain until the mind loses its self-control. At night, in the state of sleep, the mind goes away. It's very busy and hardworking. It is clear that all my sufferings are caused by the mind. Then Milarepa sings, listen to me, young shepherd. The body is between conscious and unconscious state, while the mind is the crucial and decisive factor. He who feels suffering in the lower states of being is the prisoner of samsara, the world of birth and death, world of conditioning. Yet it is the mind that can free you from this conditioned existence. Surely you want to reach the other shore of enlightenment. Surely you long for the city of well-being and liberation. If you desire to go there, my child, I can show you the way and give you instructions. And the shepherd says, certainly, dear Lama, I have made up my mind to seek it. Milarepa says, what is your name? I mean, he's been giving him teachings all these times, and he never asked him his name. Because it's immaterial. He already knew him. And he says, Sanjay Jap. How old are you? 16. So Milarepa gave him the teachings on taking refuge, exchanged his benefits and significance, and say, tomorrow when you get back home this evening, recite this prayer. And he gave him a refuge prayer. In the meantime, try to find out what is taking refuge, the mind or the body. So again, he gives him a practice, go home and recite this prayer, but he gives him this really insight practice. What's reciting this prayer? Is it the mind or your body? Okay. Next morning he comes. I don't know. Get through this. Anyhow, it's quite wonderful. I mean, he really... He describes trying to find out, is it my body or mind? Blah, 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 blah. But all of you can do the same practice and you'll find out the answer. And he talks about, but if I took refuge, and he said, you know, this past mind, future mind, and present mind. But if I took refuge with my present mind, then how can it continue on when it becomes the future mind? And if I took refuge with my past mind, then how can it, you know, come into the future? So he's... if I took refuge with my body, well, my body's always changing. Anything, all right. So he says, please, my teacher. So he's come back with, he's kind of all over the place, but he's got insight. He's really kind of followed the whole thing out. And he says, pray, my teacher, please give me an explanation. I submit everything to you. You know everything. You know what I need. All right. So you can see he comes to Milarepa with what? Total open. You know, I don't know. Teach me. And he says, and this is Milarepa's song. Whew. I sincerely pray to my guru who realized the truth of non-self. I pray with body, words, and mind. I pray with great faith and sincerity. Bless me and my disciples. Enable us to realize the truth of non-ego. Pity us and deliver us from the plight of ego clinging. So, you know, one of the reasons that he always begins with these kinds of invocations is because he is aligning himself with his lineage, with his teachings. He feels that all the teachings and understanding he has come to him through his teachers and through from his teacher, their teachers. So he's always, before he gives teachings, he always aligns himself with this lineage. Listen carefully, dear shepherd. Clinging to the notion of ego is characteristic of this consciousness. If one looks into this consciousness itself, it sees no ego. Of it, nothing is seen. To practice these teachings, in his tradition, they call it Mahamudra, the teaching of the great self, but we could call it Zen, we could call it great perfection, but this is this direct path that sees directly into the nature of mind. If one can practice this teaching, one will know how to see nothing, and yet something will be seen. To practice this teaching, one needs great faith, which means confidence, trust, humility. Humility means what? I don't think I know everything. And zeal as the foundation. One should understand the law of karma, cause and effect, as kind of the path that one walks on. In order to achieve the accomplishment of these teachings, one should depend upon a teacher for instruction and inner teaching. It requires a disciple possessing merit to receive the teaching. It requires a person who disregards comfort and suffering. It requires the courage of fearlessness, the defiance of death. Dear shepherd, can you do these things? If so, you are well destined. If not, it's better not to talk about it. Then ask yourself, and think carefully. when you sought the I, the self, the I, last night, you could not find it. This is the practice of the non-ego, non-self of personality. If you want to practice the non-ego of existence, follow my example and for 12 years meditate. Then you will understand the nature of mind. Think well on this, my boy. The shepherd said, I offer you my body and my mind. Please allow me to understand my mind definitely and clearly. Gave him some instructions, sent him off. And then, anyhow, what happens, just to paraphrase very quickly, he gives him this, he says, go home and gives him this meditation practice. The next day, the boy's parents come looking for him. They can't find him. And they go, they heard he was up in Milarepa. And Milarepa said, I haven't seen him since yesterday. And he was on his way back home. So they send out a search party. It takes him a week to find him. The parents think he's died, you know, somehow in the mountains he's died. And they find him in a week. And they find him sitting like in a hole, like in a depression in the ground, in meditation. And he does not know that a week has passed. When they come to him and they say, you know, where have you been for a week? He goes, what? Well, kind of comes out of his meditative trance.
Typical teenager,
right. he says, you know, what's been going on? And so his family then brings him down, but they say he's not the same. He just seems to have no sense of time and just in another place, and they realized, and he was, you know, so they all kind of felt miserable when they saw him in this state, and they said, what is it do you want to do, my son? And he said he wanted to go live with his teacher, Milarepa, for good. His family provided food with him and sent him to Milarepa. Milarepa first gave him the precepts of the five mindfulness trainings, the five precepts, just like we take. So he initiated him into the Dharma, preached the basic teachings of the Dharma, and granted him the teaching of the innate born wisdom. Through practice, the boy gradually attained good meditation experience, and Milarepa was really pleased. He sang him a song. Those who practice the Dharma with their mouths talk much and seem to know much teaching. But when the time comes for them to leave their deadened body, these mouth-bound preachers just are thrown off into space. When the clear light is another meaning for this basic innate illumination quality of the true mind. When it shines, it's cloaked by blindness. And the chance to see it at the time of death is lost through fear and confusion. He's talking about these people who just practice Dharma with their mouths. They seem to know much about the teaching, but it's only in their mouth. Even though one spends one's life studying the full breadth of the Buddhist teaching, at the moment of death, it is no help at all. It's interesting. He says, alas, those proficient yogis who long have practiced meditation mistake the psychic experience of illumination for transcendental wisdom. That's quite profound. So I think what he's referring to, that as one's meditative practice deepens, there is an illuminative quality, clarity to the mind that manifests. And many people think this is the end of realization. But he's talking about they're mistaking this state of illumination for transcendental wisdom. Because I think what he's referring to, that at the most profound levels, the wisdom, there is a wisdom quality to the realization when one knows the nature of things And not only does one know the true nature of things, but there is a, this mind has its own quality of wisdom and knowing, which is innate to this mind itself. And so he's saying some sort of illuminative experience of trance is a mistaken notion. It's a self-deception. My dear son, best of laymen, listen to me carefully. When your body is rightly posed and your mind absorbed deep in meditation, you may feel that thought and mind both disappear. But this is just a surface experience of meditation. By constant practice and mindfulness thereon, one feels radiant self-awareness shining like a brilliant lamp. It is pure and bright as a flower. It is like the feeling of staring into the vast and empty sky. The awareness of the void is limpid and transparent yet vivid. This non-thought, this radiant and transparent experience, is but the feeling of dhyana, or true meditation. It's a good foundation. With this foundation, one should pray to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and penetrate to reality by deeply thinking and contemplating, so that one can enter into non-ego wisdom with the beneficial life rope of deep, deep meditation. With the power of kindness and compassion, and with the altruistic vow of the enlightened heart, one can see direct and clear the truth of the enlightened path, of which nothing can be seen, and yet all is clearly seen. At that point, one sees how wrong were the fears and hopes of one's own mind. Without arriving, one reaches the place of Buddha. Without seeing, one envisions the Dharma body. Without effort, all things are done naturally. Dear son, bear this instruction in your mind. And with that, he gave the shepherd the complete initiation and verbal instruction. After practicing, then the boy attained superlative experience and realization. He was known as one of the great heart sons of Milarepa, called Repa Sanjay Jap. So I just want to give you a little taste of Milarepa and the way he taught and the kind of people he taught. We saw today he taught 16-year-old shepherd boys, he taught married couples, and he taught a deer and a dog. Yeah, forgive me for forgetting the deer and the dog. So... Anyhow, enough said.